From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
If Labor had won the election, the ACTU would have been in the box seat to exert influence on a shortened government. As things turned out, it finds itself in very different circumstances, dealing with a freshly confident Morrison government, which has already put industrial relations back on the agenda. In addition, its authority is on the line over the controversial construction union boss, John Sector, who pleaded guilty to harassing his wife but is refusing to yield to the ACTU leadership's call for him to stand down from his union position. To discuss these issues, we're joined today by Michelle O'Neill, who is ACTU president. Michelle O'Neill, to deal with John Sector first, Anthony Albanese is trying to expel him from the ALP, but now he's been given an extension of time to fight that case. On your front, you and Sally McManus are trying to get him to stand down from his union job, but he's not budging. What happens now?
Well, we've made our position very clear about the matter, and we stand by that. But decisions for unions about who leads individual unions are rightly the democratic decisions of their members.
So really you can't force him out?
Well, the way the union movement is structured is that members of unions elect their leadership, and that's an important principle. We've made our position very clear about what we think the right thing for John to do is, but ultimately it will be his union and his members that make the decision about their leadership.
Have there been any further talks with him in the last week?
No.
If the ACTU is seen to be powerless in this situation, doesn't this make something of a farce of your rhetoric against domestic violence?
I don't think so, because our track record about domestic violence is long and strong. I mean, we've been fighting for the rights of workers to have paid domestic violence leave, for example, for many years, and have actually led the world in introducing through enterprise agreements clauses that give mainly women the right to take paid leave when they're escaping domestic violence. This is something we're really proud of and are continuing to fight for. We, of course, want to see that available to every single worker, and we think it should be introduced as part of the national employment standards. We've also been part of broader campaigns about educating people, particularly men, about their behaviour and about the need to take seriously their responsibility in terms of how they treat women and equality. And we also make sure that we support broader campaigns about women having the capacity to escape when they need to escape and to have rights. So I think the Australian union movement's record about fighting for survivors of domestic violence and trying to change behaviour and attitudes is a good and strong one.
At the same time, though, when the movement's struggling for members, and particularly to get women into it, surely the whole Sector affair is particularly damaging in trying to recruit female members.
Well, the majority of Australian union members today are women. In fact, the average union member is a 46-year-old nurse. So it's been women that have been joining the trade union movement at a higher rate than men over the last decade. We think it's really important, and what matters to working people is what we're saying about the pay equity, for example, the fact that women receive 14.1% less than men in wages in Australia in 2019, that we're fighting to reverse that, that we're trying to make sure that we have here in Australia and globally protection against violence and harassment at work and in the workplace. We're part of winning at the ILO just last week a new convention on violence and harassment in the workplace, which is groundbreaking, historic convention that will change women's rights around the world. So, of course, we will fight every day for equality in workplaces, and the situation regarding one person doesn't change that.
You've got an all-female top of the ACTU now, you and Sally. What difference do you think that's made to the way the ACTU runs, or hasn't it made any?
Well, I know that as we go around the country, the number of young women that come up to us and come up to me and talk about what a difference it's made for them is remarkable.
And what do they say?
They talk about the fact that they feel proud and they feel inspired and they feel like that in their own unions and in their own work that it makes them feel like there's plenty of opportunities and new opportunities. They also talk about it making them feel stronger for the fight that they're in the middle of. It's a very common thing, a daily occurrence that young women talk to us about that. And I think it's that thing, isn't it, about girls and what they see when they're growing up. And I think seeing women in positions of leadership is so important about changing attitudes.
And are they more willing, do you think, when they see this feminised top of the ACTU tree to run for office in their own unions?
Absolutely, they are. And we've got programs that operate in most states. There was a wonderful Victorian union leader who died tragically many years ago, and the Anna Stewart program is in her memory, and it takes women, mainly young women, who are rank and file members of unions and puts them through a training program where they get to experience what it's like to be part of working for the unions and seeing on the inside how it works. And it is extraordinary the number of union leaders are now around the country in branches and national offices of unions that went through that program.
Nevertheless, the wider picture for the union movement is much more bleak. In the 1970s, half of the workforce was unionised. Now it's down to around 14% and about 9%, I think, in the private sector. Now, a lot of this decline is due to the changing nature of work and the workforce. Some's due to government changes. But how much has the union movement itself and the ACTU in particular failed in this recruitment drive, failed to sell the benefits, as you see it, of being unionised?
Well, I think we have to look at what's happened to unions, but also about what's happened in the labour market. So that corresponds with the same period of time where we see massive changes in the world of work. So I came out of the Textile Clothing and Footwear Union as a great example of that, where you've seen a wholesale change in the number of jobs in this country of workers working in that industry. When we saw a decline in membership in the Textile Clothing and Footwear Union, it absolutely represented a decline in the number of jobs and workers that were working in that industry. And of course, that goes across much of manufacturing. And the other thing that is true to say when you look at what's happening with union membership is that workers who are in casual and insecure work often move between different industries and sectors. So that does create a challenge in terms of organising and unionising those workers. They're also in short-term and insecure work and are fearful about their jobs and their future. And when people are fearful, they're not always as willing or as prepared to say, I'm a union member or want that to be known. So there's also an element of concern about whether there's going to be retribution. And of course, because of the type of laws we've got, we actually don't have, as union organisers and officials, the rights that many other union people have around the world to be able to freely talk to workers about what's happening in their workplace. For example, with wage theft, which we see rampant across a whole lot of industries where people aren't even getting the legal minimum pay, Australian unions have our hands tied behind our backs about being able to check the pay and conditions of workers in those workplaces and sectors. Now, we used to be able to easily do that. So you would be able to, without the worker having to put their hand up and identify themselves as the one that's called the union in, be able to see whether people were just being paid fairly. Now, we've got a set of laws and restrictions in the work of unions in Australia now that stop us doing it. All of that means that organising workers is a difficult job, but that doesn't mean that it's one that we are not seriously focused on. What we know is we need to change our unions and change our ways of representing and organising workers too. And there's some great examples of that happening in different sectors and industries.
Now, you mentioned government laws. Let's talk about what the government is going to do now. Firstly, it plans to bring back the Ensuring Integrity Bill to Parliament. This bill would make it easier to discipline unions and officials for transgressions. What are your objections to this legislation?
Well, this legislation is actually a very extreme and dangerous bit of law. What it does is open up the hand of government to reach into the democratic workings of unions in a way that you don't see anywhere else in the Western world. We already have a highly regulated union movement in Australia, and this bill is extreme because it does a number of things. It allows government, business, interested parties, the minister, the Fair Work Commission, the ABCC, all to be able to call and reach into how unions are run and who should lead them. It allows them to intervene in things like who should be an official or a leader of a union. It allows them to appoint administrators or ask the court to appoint administrators or to deregister parts of unions or the whole of unions. And it also allows people, even somebody off the street, to intervene about whether a union should amalgamate with another union. Now, this is extraordinary. These are basic tenets of a democracy, like free speech and freedom of the press, having the freedom to organise, the freedom for people to be able to associate is an international right in UN covenants that we've signed on to. But the government's actions here are ignoring that and putting in place standards that don't apply to any other organisation in our society. They definitely don't apply to banks, for example. There's no ensuring integrity built for banks. In fact, we've heard the banks today talk about a voluntary code of practice. So they get caught out through the Royal Commission with all sorts of extreme illegal behaviour, money being funneled into terrorism, fees for dead people. We all know the list that goes on. And that sector has a voluntary code of practice. Look at politicians. Again, a voluntary code of practice. And what do we see? Christopher Pyne, a very few short months after leaving Parliament, directly involving himself in a business that is going to benefit from his expertise and inside knowledge as the Minister for Defence. So I think this is really a thinly veiled attack on working people and their unions. It is not about integrity, it's a political attack.
Obviously, the crossbench in the Senate wouldn't buy it last time, but do you think it's more likely to get through in the aftermath of the sector affair?
Well, of course, the government's going to try and make it all about that, but it's not about that. Many of the things that this legislation captures are really actions that would be taken by a union organiser. I'll give you an example of my own. When I was an organiser in the clothing industry, I used to go into sweatshops all the time. And if you give 24 hours notice of going into a sweatshop, it's gone. It's easier to pack it up and move 10 sewing machines. So technically, I was breaching a civil breach of the Act by going into those sweatshops without giving 24 hours notice. Under this legislation, if it was through, those civil breaches could well disqualify me from being a union official, from being elected as a leader of a union. And then if I was disqualified and I gave advice to the union, I could face criminal charges. It could be grounds for having an administrator appointed by the court, and it could be grounds to stop an amalgamation. So the government wants to tell you it's about matters to do with an individual. It's actually about the organising and ordinary work of unions, which is about trying to stop wage theft and stop exploitation and protect workers.
Now, beyond this legislation, Christian Porter, who's now the relevant minister, is reviewing what changes might be needed in the whole industrial relations area. Scott Morrison has stressed that the emphasis is on promoting efficiency and that the changes need to be to the benefit of both employers and employees. Do you accept the government's general characterisation of this review, or do you see the review as some new serious threat?
I think this is a threat for workers. This is a government that repeatedly throughout the whole election campaign refused when asked by us, when asked by business, when asked by the media to release any single industrial relations policy. Zero. They said there wasn't one. So here they are, five, 6 weeks after the election, and they've announced that they're going to do a wholesale review into industrial relations. Now, why was that something they hid from the Australian public? Why weren't they on the record as saying that they were going to look at these matters during an election campaign? But even leaving that aside, the way that the Prime Minister announced it, so he announces it by asking business to come forward and say what are the things that they want to see changed in the system. Completely partisan, no concern about asking unions or the representatives of workers about what's wrong with the system or what needs to change. And then you hear the minister come out a few short days later saying, well, these are the things we're going to look at. And surprise, surprise, it's exactly the wish list of business that they've been putting to this government over many years. They want to make it easier to sack people. They want to make it easier to pay people less than the minimum wage. They want to be able to have rubber stamping of agreements rather than having them properly scrutinised. And this is the sort of changes that we've seen business asking for many years, and the government seems to be doing their bidding.
So are you going to get in there and say to Christian Porter, well, we want to put our case and here is what we think should be done, and argue against other changes that you think will be counterproductive or against your interests?
We will always advocate strongly and fight strongly for the rights of working people. So we will put our case forward.
Have you been in touch already?
We have. In fact, we've written to Christian Porter asking why he hasn't asked to meet with us. And of course, we're very happy and would like to meet with him around this matter. But the government's shown their colours on this. That won't stop us advocating and putting forward what we think, because it's important for workers, but it's also important for the economy. We've got 6 years now of stagnant wages in this country, and now we see that with the slump in retail sales, that we actually have a problem in the economy that is worse than it's been since the worst times in the 80s. So the government needs to take action to do something to lift wages, and that's where they should be focused. I mean, the issues that we want to see them focusing on is how to lift real wages, how to do something about insecure work, which the minister, again, in his announcement of this, seems to doubt that there's an issue. We have the third highest rate of insecure work in Australia in the OECD. So we will raise these issues. We want to see them addressed.
Now, just before we move on to the wage issue in more detail, how do you see Scott Morrison? Do you see him as an ideological warrior on industrial relations, or do you think, in fact, he'll be more pragmatic?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think that Scott Morrison tried to reinvent himself during the period of the election campaign. We were surprised when he became leader how few people remembered the action he'd taken in previous portfolios. What we saw in those previous portfolios was that he was a very interventionist and ideological minister. So I don't think a leopard necessarily changes his spots.
But he wasn't in industrial relations.
No, not in industrial relations. I'm talking more about the style he adopted in previous portfolios.
It'll be immigration, where he was obviously very tough. But social security, I would have thought, had a record in part of negotiating, did he not?
Look, I think that for example, in Social Security, he was part of refusing to do anything about Newstart, which is, not just the union movement, but many business as well as civil society organisations have for so many years now said this is a crime, really, that people are trying to survive on such low amount of money. And I was, talking about immigration when I was characterising his interventionist approach. It'll be interesting to see how he evolves as a Prime Minister. We, of course, would always hope that he would be prepared to be somebody that would listen to both sides and not adopt a sort of anti-union, anti-worker agenda. But the signs aren't good as to how it's been in the last short period of time. And the announcements they've made really seem to be biased towards business around this review. It does fill us with concern. But we're going to be loudly advocating for the issues. And as I said, we think it's good for the economy, not just good for workers.
Now, just coming back to wages and the economy, we've got penalty rates, Sunday penalty rates, now going down again. What changes, being realistic, given that Labor didn't win, but what changes do you think are needed in the wage fixing system to make it fairer, to enable wage rises that are more than the current very small amounts?
Well, we've actually written to Scott Morrison suggesting three simple things that could be done that would stimulate wages and do something for the economy. The first of those is to reverse those penalty rate cuts. We can't see that there's any justification for workers whose job hasn't changed, hasn't got any easier, they're not working less, and in fact, many cases working harder, to see their wages go backwards. These are low-paid workers. The majority of them are women, and they're not working Sundays because they love working Sundays. They're working because they're low-paid.
But so just before you go on to the other changes you're advocating, isn't this a matter for the Fair Work Commission, which after all made that decision?
Well, the government hasn't had problems intervening in decisions in the past. You might remember there was the Safe Rates Tribunal that was about trying to do something about the shocking rate of deaths that happen on our roads in the trucking industry. That was an independent tribunal that was established, that was dealing with wages and conditions, and the government intervened not just to disagree with the decision of it, but actually to abolish the whole thing. So they seem to pick and choose what they'll intervene on. They had an opportunity in the last parliament 8 times to vote in support of legislating to restore penalty rates and chose not to do so. So I don't accept that they can't do anything about it. Of course they can. And if you look at wage stagnation, they should, and they should act. And it hits the lowest paid the hardest. Like, it hits women the hardest. It hits people who are already in insecure work the hardest. There's no justification for it. It's a terrible decision, and it's adding to people living in poverty.
And your other changes that you're proposing?
The other two things are that I think that they also should look at restoring or re-putting back into our system in legislation the notion of a living wage rather than just a minimum wage. We've seen people who are on the minimum wage in Australia, and their proportion of pay comparative to those who are on the median wage has got less and less. And many of the people who are on the minimum wage, it's only now just $38,500 per annum, are living in poverty. There is tens of thousands of people who are working full-time who are homeless. So doing something about having a new set of principles that puts back into the decision-making of the Fair Work Commission that nobody should be living in poverty if they're on the minimum wage and working full-time is an important change that I think would send the right message for those who are making the decisions about the minimum wage. The third thing is, of course, the people who work directly for the government. This government has been involved in suppressing wage increases in the public sector over a long period of time, and there's been long and bitter disputation around that. Workers in the public service have had very low wage increases. That's something the government could directly intervene on that would be a stimulus to the economy too. So they're three simple things that we've written to the government about that we think would immediately address a boost to wages.
Just finally, do you think that we need a better relationship between the union movement and employers generally as a way to promote productivity in the economy?
Well, I think part of the way that's often displayed as if there's a sort of war happening between the union movement and employers. And of course, that's not the reality on the ground. There's many employers and businesses that work very constructively with unions and workers and recognise the importance of treating people with dignity and respect and giving them fair wages and conditions and safe workplaces. They just don't make the news. So I think we do have a really constructive relationship with many businesses and with many business organisations. We've got a lot in common when we talk about things like the problem, for example, with the decimation of the TAFE system and what that's done to skill and education. And we also have similar concerns about making sure that we have a sustainable and ethical future around the sort of jobs that are created, that we're creating jobs that are jobs for the long term, that they're jobs that are going to be considerate of the impact of climate change, that they are also looking at making sure that Australia can proudly be a nation that has fair and ethical treatment of workers and not seen to be part of a race to the bottom. I mean, that's something that will help our global exports. That's a global trend that affects what people buy and the services they want to have. So all of these things are things that reputable businesses are happy to talk to us about.
Michelle O'Neill, thank you very much for talking with us today. And that's all for today's Conversations Politics podcast. Thank you to my producer, Rashna Farooq, and we'll be back with another interview very soon. Goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevier. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.